Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we're still talking about Shantideva.
Lots of work.
We all have a lot of work to do. Chapter 6 on patience. This is from Guide to the Bodhisattva Way. Shantideva was 8th century Indian monk. Who knew whereof he spoke? Okay, so these verses have to do with dealing with anger which arises when enemies are praised by others and also our own desire for praise. Good, huh?
Yeah.
All right, the first verse is, when people describe my own good qualities, I want others to be happy too. Yeah? But when they describe the good qualities of others, I do not wish to be happy myself. Does that sound familiar? Has that ever happened to you? Okay, so, you know, we really like it when people are happy about things that we have done that are considered praiseworthy. And we don't like it when people that we don't like get praised for things that they've done that are considered to be meritorious. Now, Shantideva is assuming that the person actually is doing meritorious actions, but I'd like to point out that often when we don't like that person, we don't consider anything that they do to be meritorious, and therefore we have to struggle with that. So that's the essentially what's going on here is that... Is this kind of, I would say, almost like a knee-jerk response, you know? I think we like to rationalize and bolster our own opinion about these things. So it's interesting because it's not just about, I mean, Shantideva is so logical, right? He says, like, logically, like, why should you, if you like to be praised, why isn't it okay for your enemies to be praised? So that's the kind of logic of this. But of course, it's not based on logic, it's based on emotion. Like, this is our afflictive emotion of, I hate this person, they are my enemy, therefore there's absolutely nothing about them that's good. They have no good qualities. So that's kind of, I think, where we come from. And in some ways, it's interesting because all of these kinds of afflictive emotions, why is it that we get so upset? Like, what's happening here that we get so upset about this? So somehow I think it boils down to it's impinging upon our sense of self. There's something about this that deeply brings up fear about something that's going to happen. So that's something to look at. That's a bit the basis here of what he's saying. The next verse is, having generated the awakening mind through wishing all beings to be happy, why should I become angry if they find some happiness themselves? So we don't do this particular practice here, but Vipassana certainly does. You know, may all beings be happy. We say that. May all beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering. We have this aspiration to alleviate the suffering. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them or benefit them. So we have these vows that we take, our bodhisattva vows, and yet, right out the window, when these big emotions arise. So again, Shantideva, being very logical himself, he's pointing out, he's saying, having generated the awakening mind through wishing all beings to be happy, so having generated this vow, having generated the mind of bodhicitta, desiring to have the mind of the bodhisattva, the precepts say, you know, in the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no hate. In the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no stealing. So to say it that way is to say that in the mind of the bodhisattva, these activities just don't even come to mind. So in the mind of the bodhisattva, there is no ill will. So the bodhisattva does not even have that thought of ill will. It's kind of like when we make jokes about somebody that are not particularly nice. It's interesting because we say, oh, well, I'm just teasing. But actually, if the thought never arose in our mind to begin with, then, right, you get my drift here. So this way that we look at that and say, well, that's very interesting. What's up with that, right? So to start, to generate this, to look at the logic of what we're doing, and it says, so why should I become angry if they find some happiness themselves? So why is it that we get so upset when somebody's praised, or we get jealous? Maybe we're jealous, or we get depressed. So if my aspiration to is engage in sympathetic joy, if my aspiration is to benefit all beings, why am I unwilling to look at my resistance to these teachings? So right now, if you're feeling resistance to these teachings because you're thinking of some particular thing that might have engendered some of these negative emotions in you of late, then it's like to ask yourself the question, just to be willing to ask, why would I resist these teachings? Why would I be willing to have this resistance? I was thinking about something that I did recently that was impatient. Yesterday, I'll make this confession. Yesterday, I was driving my car and I wanted to go see that movie, A Star is Born. And I was like 5 minutes before the movie was supposed to start. So over here in the Save Mart parking lot, I don't know if you live in the neighborhood, but basically in that parking lot, I just feel like people just wander around mindlessly out of the Save Mart, you know, and we're all supposed to come to a screeching halt. Now, you can just tell by the way I'm talking about this, how I'm thinking about this particular issue. So there was a woman who was crossing the street. I didn't, you know, think that she was far enough out in the street for me to stop, but she did, and she got unhappy about it. So I was thinking about that, and I started out thinking to myself, you know, there's absolutely no reason to be impatient. Impatience is not okay. Like, you need to really work on this. You really need to work on being impatient. And then this other voice said to me, yes, but. Yes, but. You know? And then I thought, well, maybe I should have stopped my car and gone out in a very nice way and said to her, why do you think it's okay for you to cross the street? It's like the yes, but. So when our mind goes to the yes, but, and then beyond that to the but I could have, right? In a nice way, in a skillful way. So then I came back to, okay, let's go back to the beginning of this, which is you caused this person to be upset and fearful and upset with you. And maybe you need to be looking at this rather than saying yes, but. Right? So what is this resistance? You know, what is this resistance? What is it about the practice of no self? Because this is essentially what this is. The practice of no self is so incredibly hard. You know, it's so incredibly hard. In the abstract, the notion of interpenetration, interconnection, as the genesis of compassion sounds so lovely. But in the reality of that, it's like, ugh, I don't want that. I don't want that. So if my aspiration is to engage in sympathetic joy or benefiting all beings, why am I unwilling to look at my resistance to these teachings? Why is it? Why is it? So we have to, in some ways, we have to be vigilant, you know, with ourselves. The teaching arises, we say, good thing. Then we start thinking about the situation and how we might have acted and how it might have kind of gotten in the way of our desire to get to the movies. Which, you know, often when we have these feelings, they're physical, right? It's not just a kind of mental construct of, gee, I'd like to get to the movies on time. It's a physical impatience. It's a physical emotion of jealousy or envy or hate or all of those kind of negative. So by the way, are good, you know, beneficial emotions, joy, love, compassion, empathy. Those are also physical things. But the ones that are difficult to deal with in a way, they kind of drive us. And so sitting Zazen, doing the practice, engaging and remembering our vow helps us to take a deep breath, right? To take a deep breath. Count to 10. Stop the car. Remembering, coming back. Remember, the word remember is remember. Reconnect, reconstitute, come back together with not just your vow, but your relationship to all being, that we are not separate. So this way that we come back together. Shanti Deva says, in the next line, he says, if I wish for all sentient beings to become Buddhas, then why am I tormented when I see them receiving mere mundane respect? Why am I tormented by this? Now, this is kind of interesting because from our doctrinal position, all beings are already Buddha, right? So it's not about becoming a Buddha, which Shantideva probably believed that doctrinal teaching, which was that lifetime after lifetime we're reborn, and somehow in the process of that and the experiences that we have, we are able to reach some state where we could become a Buddha. But essentially from the position of Soto Zen and Chinese Buddhism, the very fact that we are in this complete interconnected relationship called the world, worlding the world, the very fact of that, which we all know is true now, it's not sort of an idea, we know that this is true. Scientifically, we know that everything is in this interconnected relationship, everything. So that essentially is the definition of Buddha. Because if we respond from that point of view, if that's the way that we respond to the world, understanding that we are not separate in this way, that we are in this completely interconnected dance with each other, dependent upon each other, and I'm not just talking about people, right? But dependent upon each other, that everything is like this process. If we deeply and really truly understood that, we could work out things. We could work out our differences. We could take care of the environment. We could do all of the things that we see as being a problem. They would all be doable because we would have this intrinsic respect and curiosity about the function of what we perceive as other. And we would have a dialogue and we would look at that and be able to see that and talk about that without having our sense of self being so challenged, so frightened, so concerned that we cannot even engage in dialogue. So from our position of our teaching, everything, every being are, as Dogen says in Busho, he says, beings are not, the teaching was beings have Buddha nature. He said, no, beings are Buddha nature. All beings are Buddha nature. Now, do all beings exhibit Buddha nature? No. Do we need to work on this? Yes. Dogen says in Busho somewhere else, essentially, he says, at the moment of the enactment of the reality of our Buddha nature-ness, Buddhahood arises. So although Buddha nature is the state of, is the essential nature of our complete universe, everything in it, Buddha nature. And yet for that to be enacted, it has to be enacted. It cannot be just an idea that we have about the nature of our experience. It has to be an enacted idea. And that enacted idea simultaneously brings alive the truth of Buddha nature. So, does that make sense to you? It's like it requires, on our part as human beings, I don't know about what it's like to be this bell. I don't know what it's like to be a stone. I don't know what it's like to be a white-crowned sparrow. I don't know what it's like to be those other beings. I don't know if it takes them effort to practice. I don't know if there's like white-crowned sparrow transmission, you know, that you get from the great white-crowned sparrow teacher. That's the white-crowned sparrow's problem. Our problem as human beings is how do we do what we do? You know, how do we make our effort? And one of the ways, of course, is that we look at the teachings of Shantideva and we say, oh, I hate that. I don't like that. I don't want to do that. Or at the same time, we go, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's so inspiring, you know. Now can I go to the Save Mart and actually stop the car, you know, when there's a pedestrian who's even just thinking about crossing. Just thinking about it. I can tell. I know. They've got that look in their eye. They actually want to cross the street. No, I don't want to stop. No, please, don't make me stop. You must stop. You must stop. Really? Do you know what I mean? So that we like remember our vow in that moment, and we're willing to stop the car, willing to do whatever it is that we're doing in that moment, that we know is the right thing to do, and that we actually engage in that activity, that we wake up to that activity. And everyone, even though they are not engaged in Buddhahood activity, right? All beings are Buddha, that faith that all things are Buddha nature, which means that no one, no thing, no situation is a lost cause. This notion that even though not awakened, still Buddha nature. To have faith in that, not a kind of mindless faith, not a run over me faith, not, as Trungpa Rinpoche said, idiot compassion, but this curiosity, this willingness to entertain that, this willingness to come from that position, that we are able to communicate with an open mind. Because when we have this mindset, we can have a dialogue with other people that is perhaps not what we want as an outcome. Maybe the dialogue doesn't bring about some kind of person who immediately says, yes, I completely agree with you. You are so smart. Because that's what we want, right? We want to have that dialogue where somebody says, oh yeah, I completely agree with you. You. Again, that's that place of small self where we really want that other person to get our point of view. But because, of course, our point of view is the most efficacious point of view. Our point of view is the best point of view. So this way in which we say, oh, okay, I'm willing to be curious. I'm willing to see it from your point of view. I'm willing to say, yeah, there might be some merit to that. I'm willing to be that, to have that. You know, there was that story going around, I don't know, a few months ago, about the guy who is the white supremacist. And he ran into some pastor or somebody at a bar. I can't remember. I'm vague on the details here. And the upshot was that this guy was really nice to him, to the white supremacist, and just kind of befriended him and sort of took him in. And he changed his mind about what was happening. Now, this in some ways is a kind of apocryphal story that we hear and we say, oh yeah, you know, it's like if I just stick in there and I'm open and inclusive and loving, then that's going to change somebody. And then we say, well, why aren't you changing? You know, I've done this for 2 months, why aren't you changing? You know, so we have to let go of the why aren't you changing part and just do the best that we can do, really make that effort to come forward and be inclusive in the ways that we can be inclusive. Again, this isn't some kind of idiot compassion where you do so much more than you're capable of doing. It's kind of destructive. Does that make sense? But this way in which we actually with a kind of sane mind, look at what are we capable of? What is it that we can do? How can we respond? How can we make that extra effort? How can we talk to ourselves about this and remember our vow? Then Shanti David says, what does it matter if my enemy is given something or not? What does it matter if my enemy is given something or not? Whether he obtains it or whether it remains in the benefactor's house, in either case I should get nothing. So this would be something at work. I don't know, maybe somebody gets promoted as boss and you're like upset about it. You feel like you should have been the boss, but this other person got it, and in any case, you're not going to get it, and so essentially, you're not going to get it, right? Or somebody you don't know has a lot of money or something like that, and so you're saying, well, gosh, why shouldn't I have a lot of money? But the point is, you don't have a lot of money, and you're not going to get a lot of money. So it's, you know. So he says, kind of have this clear eye about, what, you know, why be upset or angry with somebody because they won the lottery? You know, you didn't even buy a ticket. So there's this way in which he's, again, he's pointing out this kind of illogical mindset that we have about how we relate to people. So he says, why, by becoming angry, do I throw away my merits, the faith others have in me, and my good qualities? So this way in which when something good happens to somebody else and we get angry or jealous, we're throwing away our merits. We're kind of throwing away our practice. We're doing this thing that is like kind of saying, oh, this kind of indulgence of tossing away the effort that we've made in the past. So, and also this, maybe the faith others have in us. I went to the Deshi meeting. We went to a Deshi meeting, which is a meeting of the disciples of your teacher who gave you Dharma transmission. So we were at a Deshi meeting last Saturday with Mel Weitzman. And Mel said something that I found like incredibly profound as a teacher. He said, I have to show students how, something like this, I have to show students how to die well. Do you remember that, Chaplin?
Yeah.
Do you remember what exactly how he said that?
Well, he was talking about how when he first started, he had to show people how to sit well, even though he was struggling himself. And then he's 89 now, and he's in good health. But he said, I need to show people how to die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in each phase, as a teacher, I had to show people how to sit, even though it was uncomfortable for me. I have to show people how to die, which what he didn't say, but my guess is even though I might be frightened at the time, even though I might have all of these, and how to show people how to die even in the midst of your fear, right? Not to deny it. So this way so this is not just about being a teacher, although as a teacher I find this quite moving that he said that, but as practitioners, that even in the midst of our difficulties of doing this practice, we show each other how to do the practice. Even in the midst of how hard it is, we show each other that we are doing this practice. So faith in others, the faith that others have in me, and I thought of this story about Mel because when, as teachers, people have faith in you, they have faith in you that you're doing the practice. So I must say as a teacher, I feel a responsibility maybe to do the practice in places where I might not want to do the practice because I think, well, I'm up here giving these talks, you know, about this. This puts an onus of responsibility on me to actually walk the walk. But the same thing is true for all of us who take vows, right? When we follow this path and we do this practice, the onus is on us to do the practice. No one else is going to do it for us. So we all have this pact, if you will, with each other that we are going to support each other and have faith in each other to do the practice. So why am I not angry with myself for not having the causes for gain? So why am I not angry with myself for not receiving this by, you know, I don't know what he was thinking of in particular, but, you know, if I don't become the boss, then why is that? Instead of getting angry, to ask the question, why is that? You know? To go to the boss, this boss, and say, why is it? You know, what do I need to work on? This way in which, instead of getting into the blaming, jealousy, envy, anger, hate, ill will mode, to ask ourselves, what could I have done? If this is what I want, how do I get what I want? In a way that is, in our case, in a way that is ethical, you know, all those good qualities. And then he says, let alone. Okay, so then he says, you know, we're having the feeling jealousy and anger or whatever it is. We've experiencing from this a loss of merit, trust, diminished reputation. So those are all kind of pitfalls of going into this mind state. Shanti Devi said, let alone not having any remorse about the evils that you have committed, O mind. So he's talking to himself. Let alone not having any remorse about the evils that you have committed, O mind, why do you wish to compete with others who have committed meritorious deeds? And so, again, he's talking about this notion that people are engaged in meritorious deeds. But then I was thinking about, well, what about more complicated situations? Like, for instance, the recent, you know, confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh. That feels like a more complicated situation. Now, it's interesting. None of us know him. None of us know probably any of the people involved in these decision-making processes. But I'm sure that we all have very strong views, many of us do, about the things that have happened. And those views may be very emotional. Like, it might feel a lot of emotional and a lot of feeling. So you may view Kavanaugh as an enemy, or the people who support him as an enemy. You may view Kavanaugh as a hero, and the people who supported him also as heroes. You may view the people who opposed him as a threat. So this way in which we have these different views based on what we wanted to happen. So if you didn't want Judge Kavanaugh to be confirmed, then from this point of view, you should not hate those who do, nor should you hate, I don't remember his first name, Judge Kavanaugh.
Brett
Kavanaugh. So this way in which we're being said, no, if you didn't want him to be confirmed, then you do not hate those who did, nor should you, by the way, expect their sympathy. Right? Although you may take action to counter the ramifications of this turn of events, you want to do those actions without violence, envy, or jealousy. Okay? So this teaching is, again, this teaching is not about not doing anything if there's some situation that you would like to see happen in this way or that way, but it's about cultivating the mind which those actions are not taken out of anger, ill will, jealousy, hatred, envy, all of those kind of negative emotions. That you keep your mind, you know, you keep your sanity, you keep your balance in the midst of this. If you want a Judge Kavanaugh to be confirmed, you may be very happy and feel vindicated. So there's this way in which people who wanted to see Judge Kavanaugh confirmed are probably very, very happy right now. So Judge Kavanaugh and all of those people, I'm just coming from the position of probably the majority of people in this room might have wanted to see his confirmation next. Right. And yet it doesn't really matter which side you're on in this particular teaching. It doesn't matter whether you are wanted him to be confirmed or you didn't want him to be confirmed. Because whether you are happy, 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 the teaching of that is don't gloat about it, right? Don't go around saying, ha, 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 I got you. I hate you. I hate you, and look, I vanquished you. You know, you are now, you are prostrate and depressed, and you are vanquished. That's a kind of, ill will and lack of empathy. On the other side, if it's like, I hate you, you got what you wanted. You know, Susan Collins, may you roast in hell. You know, it's like, you know, then you look at it from that position and you go, what is that about? What is that about? You know, Susan Collins or Brett Kavanaugh or Donald Trump. All of those people are Buddha nature. Are Buddha nature. Not are going to get it in, 5,000 billion lifetimes. Are Buddha nature. All of those people, based on the causes and conditions of their life, just as we are struggling with, or working with, are trying to find what seems like the best solution to the problems that they're faced with. Whether we agree with it or not. So this way in which, how can we create a kind of equanimity? Because right now, this is so important. You know, in Santa Cruz, in some ways, we're really lucky because you're probably going to run into somebody who agrees with you. But I know people who don't agree with this mindset. There's a person who I chat with quite amicably who runs business in the neighborhood who doesn't agree with this, you know? And I absolutely think this is a wonderful person. It's so wonderful to talk with her, you know? And if I ever did have to talk with her about politics, I think she and I could probably have a conversation that was amicable about it. Because we would both be coming from this position of liking the other person, which is a really good place to start. Respecting, not necessarily liking or loving, but respecting and being curious about and being open to the other person's point of view. And if you don't agree with it, go out and do something about it. Right? But you know what? You can't always get what you want. I was watching something on MSNBC and I noticed that the background music was, you can't always get what you want. They were playing like that Rolling Stones song. I thought, well, that's really interesting. It's sort of subliminal message to all of us, liberals over a certain age. So who's that bodhisattva who came up with that music in the background? So it's important that we take our bodhisattva vow and use it to inform and temper our response. It's not that we shouldn't have a response, but that we use it to temper and inform and guide the way that the shape and the way that we engage in this practice. If we're serious about our practice, we have to look at our hate, our delusion, ill will, and especially we have to look at our fear. Because fear is the genesis of all of these afflictive emotions. It's what we're frightened of. It's what we're afraid is going to happen. We have to look at that. Ask ourselves, why am I so frightened of this? You know? How can I honor that in a way and at the same time be skillful? Take a good look at it. Own your fear and then work to dispel it in order to be efficacious and helpful in your life, in your practice, in your politics, because this is a very difficult time, and hate does not heal and it does not foster dialogue. Shanti Deva's next verse is, and even if he, your enemy, does suffer as you wished, what is there for you to be joyful about? If you say, for I shall be satisfied, how could there be anything more wretched than that? how could there be anything more wretched than knowing that your desire for this person to be harmed, the ill will that you felt, has been satisfied and brought forward? Really? Do we really want to have that kind of a mindset about people that we disagree with, who are being unskillful? Is that really what we want? This hook cast by the fishermen of disturbing conceptions, okay, this hook cast by the fishermen of disturbing conceptions is unbearably sharp. So I love this. It's like, here's the disturbing conceptions, hate, ill will, greed, delusion, fishing for us. Wait a minute, I'm not bait. You know, fishing for us. And there we are. You know, there we are. He says, this hook cast by the fishermen of disturbing conceptions is unbearably sharp. Having been caught on it, it is certain that I shall be cooked in the cauldrons of the guardians of hell. I shall be cooked in the cauldrons of the guardians of hell. War, hate, delusion, ill will. Double, double, triple, and triple. I've got another one, you know. And even if your enemy, and if I were aware of what held meaning for me, what value would I find in these things? So if we go back to our vow, if we remember this, if we remember why we're practicing, if we remember what we know about the true nature of this world, the true nature of our relationships, our deepest desire, what value would we find in these things? What value would we find in jealousy and envy and revenge and hate and greed and delusion? If I have my priorities straight and I want to help all beings and practice and cause other things to be efficacious and to be skillful, I would never be attracted to this kind of negative, harmful thinking and desire for others to be harmed. So we are attracted, though. We do get caught. So it's not that we're horrible, terrible people, but it is that we do get caught on that hook, you know. And we don't even know that we're in this cauldron with the guardians of these hell realms. So let's get out of the pot. Let's do our best to get ourselves out of the hot water. Take a deep breath. Help each other do the practice. Help each other kind of stay sane in the midst of all this, no matter what side we are on. And maybe stop thinking about it as I'm on this side or that side. And just about all of us fallible human beings, fallible Buddhas, trying to make sense of this very, very, very complicated world we live in. Thank you.